Good evening, everyone. This is Dr. Nalini Chilkov. Welcome. This is our monthly live Grand Rounds call for the Foundations of Integrative Oncology course. The call will last approximately 1 hour. I'll start with a clinical pearl. I'll move into a case study and then questions. Between each section, I'll pause. So if you have any questions about what I just spoke about, you'll have an opportunity to ask them. You're all muted right now, and if you want to speak, just hit *7. And if you're on a web call, you can use the chat box, and we'll monitor those questions as well, so that when we take breaks, everybody can ask a question. I want to remind everyone, if you want to submit a question or a case, please use the form that's on the website, the course website platform. That really helps me to have standardized way to review all the cases and questions and then put them into our system for you and into our calls for you. This evening, I'm going to talk about angiogenesis and some phytochemicals that inhibit angiogenesis. That will be our clinical pearl. Then there was a very interesting malignant melanoma case that was submitted. And then there's a question about glioblastoma and lion's mane mushroom. And I'm really glad to see that Dr. DeAndre is on the call, so you can give us your opinion on that too. So I will just jump right in. So I you should have gotten an email that has the slides and the case study in it if you want to be able to follow along as I'm lecturing. If you haven't already, you can look in your email. You should find PDF documents of my clinical pearl slides and the case study notes. All right, so let's talk about angiogenesis. Why is it so important in the first place? Because it's one of the most powerful things we can do to inhibit angiogenesis. This is one of the best ways to exert control over tumor cell progression. And so we'll learn the process of that. And the other reason I think it's so important for us to talk about it is because there really are not very effective tools for inhibiting angiogenesis in conventional oncology. There are a few things like Avastin, but they produce resistance very quickly in most patients, so their benefit is relatively short-lived. And we can actually exert angiogenic control over long periods of time. And this is a way of putting the brakes on tumor progression. And so think about the patient who's gone through successful treatment and they are officially no evidence of disease, or we know they just have microscopic disease, or we know that they have a low level of a not very aggressive tumor cell line. And we have a way to put the brakes on that and just halt the progression, then that's a worthy goal. Now, remember that inhibiting angiogenesis is not cytotoxic, so we're not killing tumor cells. But if we could take control of whether or not they spread from a primary site through the blood or lymphatic system to secondary sites, then we are also inhibiting metastasis. But we can also just inhibit the growth of a tumor mass by inhibiting angiogenesis. So it's a really powerful thing to do. And we have a great toolbox. And I'll just, before I start, I'll tell you a story. I have two stage 3 ovarian cancer patients who are kind of twin patients. They went through their neoadjuvant chemotherapy, their debulking surgery, and their post-surgical chemotherapy, and they both ended up no evidence of disease. And so they had good outcomes, and they did a full outsmart cancer protocol during the whole time and had more remarkable results than the oncologist or the surgeon would have imagined. And one of the patients chose to go into a study with one of my oncology colleagues using Avastin, an angiogenesis inhibitor, and a PARP inhibitor because she was BRCA positive. And she's still no evidence of disease 10 months later, but she is full of toxic side effects that are really debilitating to her, and therefore on a lot of extra drugs. She's having severe migraines on these treatments, and so I just feel they're too toxic for her. The other patient said, I'm done with drugs. I'm not interested in more drugs. But she's also an incredibly compliant patient, and I have her on a very aggressive protocol, and she's also no evidence of disease, and her oncologist is very curious about watching her. She just hit her 1-year mark, and most ovarian cancer patients recur within 6 months. If you make it 2 years, that's great. If you make it to 2 years, you probably won't recur in an aggressive way. So the oncologist I work with is very interested in looking at other ways of accomplishing angiogenesis control and PARP inhibition, which we're doing with nutraceuticals and botanicals. So the lever of angiogenesis is incredibly important to also prevent a recurrence, right, and metastatic progression. So angiogenesis literally means blood vessel formation. And in the cancer setting, it also means that we're looking at blood vessel formation that involves migration, growth, and differentiation of those endothelial cells. And the angiogenesis relative to a tumor is when a tumor actually signals a nearby capillary to bud towards it to begin making a network of capillaries to provide nutrients and oxygen. And then, of course, once that happens, the tumor cells have access to the circulation and can migrate and metastasize. And, of course, as soon as that capillary blood flow comes to a small tumor, then the growth becomes exponential as well. So this is what we want to inhibit. Now, if you have a little mass of cancer cells that's about a millimeter, then you don't need a blood supply because nutrients can exchange through their surface. But once there's enough cell division and then there's hypoxia and lack of nutrients in the center, then that's when hypoxia-inducible factor becomes expressed and a whole cascade of other signaling molecules that allow angiogenesis to unfold, one of which is vascular endothelial growth factor, and Avastin is an inhibitor of that particular growth factor. And so I've included, for those of you who are very visual, a number of slides that just show a little harmless tumor with no blood supply. And it's not going to do much, but once it needs a blood supply, it sends signals to the local capillary, and then you get this exponential growth and access to the vascular tree. That includes the lymphatic as well as the blood vessels. And so this is when we have the opportunity for disease progression, both locally and systemically. Now, the expression of hypoxia-inducible factor comes along with other factors that get expressed, such as you get an increase in matrix metalloproteinases, you get an increase in fibroblast growth factor, and you get an increase in the little pericyte formations, which are like the scaffolding around capillary walls. I will say that the capillaries that form in tumors as a result of tumor angiogenesis are very chaotic and not very beautiful, smooth, orderly capillaries. So they're not as efficient as healthy, normal angiogenesis that occurs, for example, after an injury or surgery to bring blood flow to an injured area where there was an incision or trauma. So we don't have the same kind of capillaries that form around a tumor. But nevertheless, those smart little tumor cells are figuring out how to survive and grow and flourish and travel. And you'll also see an upregulation of inflammatory factors. One of the things that's really interesting, if you track vascular endothelial growth factor in the serum, if you track hypoxia-inducible factor 1 or 2 in the serum, these are directly correlated with prognosis and disease progression. So the more VEGF, the more hypoxia-inducible factor that is present, the worse the prognosis. And you can measure VEGF in the serum through Quest or LabCorp. Those are definitely available. And you can see in some pathology reports the presence of VEGF receptors in some pathology reports, not routine, some things you can ask for also. But so that's just sort of the basic physiology. And remember that angiogenesis is therefore a rate-limiting step in the development of cancer. And so if we can exert our influence there, we can exert limitation and inhibit tumor growth, progression, and metastasis. So that's the why. And it's really important. So remember that the tumor just needs a blood supply to survive, to grow larger, and to be able to invade and metastasize. Now, here's a really interesting fact. I found this article called Targeting Tumor Angiogenesis for Cancer Prevention. And this data was noted that in normal blood vessels, in normal vasculature, it's kind of a quiescent process. There isn't a lot of angiogenesis going on unless there's trauma. And the endothelial cells of the blood vessels are not really dividing much at any given time, and they might have a doubling time ranging from 47 days to 20,000 days, which means it's very quiescent. But in contrast, the doubling rate for tumor endothelial cells is 2 to 13 days. So this is an active process. So if we stop it, we do exert influence. Now, you'll see when we get to the Materia Medica section of this mini lecture on angiogenesis that a lot of the botanicals and phytochemicals we already use have angiogenic potential, anti-angiogenic potential. I included a slide here that's from Dr. William Lee, who has the Angiogenesis Foundation, angio.org, and he lists quite a number of food phytochemicals. And he has a mission of educating the public about the impact of diet on health and on cancer. And then I added a few things to his slide. So remember that vitamin D and vitamin A, the retinoic acids, are pro-differentiation and anti-proliferative. So they also have a relationship to angiogenesis. A lot of the phytophenols, the anthocyanidins, and flavonoids and polyphenols, the proanthocyanidins, they all have anti-angiogenic. So what does that mean? Anything with color has a lot of anti-angiogenic properties, EGCG, resveratrol, vitamin K, selenium, N-acetylcysteine, ginseng, genistein, ellagic acid, which is in raspberries and strawberries, lycopene from tomatoes, the glucosinolates and isothiocyanates from the cruciferous vegetables, parthenolide from feverfew, hanokale from magnolia bark. So the salvia and the sclerea, I'm going to talk about some of those more specifically. But there's a lot of angiogenic molecules in nature. And there's a really wonderful article that was published in 2019 that I've referenced here for you, Phytochemicals Targeting VEGF and VEGF-Related Multifactors as Anti-Cancer Therapy. That's this year that was published and really takes a good look at the abundance of anti-angiogenic chemicals in plants. I also included a slide of some of the more therapeutic phytochemicals that we use in the oncology setting, things like artemisinin and berberine and curcumin, quercetin, thymoquinone, all the ginsenosides, the tantinones from salvia, and the sulforaphanes we mentioned. So we just have a really big materia medica, and so we can do a better job of this than they're doing right now in conventional oncology. So I found this really wonderful article that was published in Integrative Cancer Therapies in 2018 that has four Chinese herbs that it talks about. The title is Targeting VEGF and VEGF Receptor Pathways in the anti-angiogenic treatment of human cancers with traditional Chinese medicine. And so I think they should call this with modern Chinese medicine, because we're really talking about phytochemicals we know about because of modern science. So they talked about four widely used botanicals in integrative oncology. And so I want to just bring your attention to them and bring your attention to this paper. So those four are Salvia miltiariza, Danshen, Panax ginseng or Renshen, Curcuma longa, which is, of course, turmeric in Chinese, Yujian and Jianghuang, and Scutellaria vicolensis, which we talk a lot about, Huangqin. So let me just briefly go over what the anti-angiogenic phytochemicals in those, and then you'll see how the way we build our treatment plans, remember that molecules from nature are just amazing multitaskers. So Scutellaria vicolensis, as you all know, is one of my favorite botanicals and is used widely in modern Chinese formulas for tumor control, but it's a super anti-inflammatory as well. There are two flavonoids in Scutellaria vicolensis, bicalin and wagonin, that have a multiplicity of actions, including anti-angiogenic signaling. They inhibit VEGF. They inhibit fibroblast growth factor receptor 2, the lipoxygenases, and they also impact the ability of endothelial cells to migrate and aggregate. So they inhibit that. Inhibits NF-kappa B, inhibits hypoxia-inducible factor 1, IGF-1, the PI3K-AKT pathway, which is common in many, many cancers, and the B-catenin-Wnt pathway, which is common in many cancers. So again, we're just reminding you how if you just learn a handful of powerful botanicals, you can hit a lot of pathways and have a lot of impact. So that was the factors in Scutellaria vicolensis Huangqin that have anti-VEGF, anti-angiogenic capacities. Next is one of my absolutely favorite Chinese herbs, red sage root, Dan Shen, Salvia miltiariza. And the active principles in that are the tansinones, tansinone 1A and 2A, and cryptotansinone. This is actually my favorite botanical to reduce fibrosis as well. This group of phytochemicals also inhibits NF-kappa B and TNF-alpha, and also promotes differentiation, also inhibits hypoxia-inducible factor 1A, and inhibits the expression of the VEGF receptors as well, also pro-apoptotic and inhibitory to cell cycle, and inhibition of the matrix metalloproteinases. Remember that when we talked about the blood-brain barrier and how to protect the blood-brain barrier, the upregulation and expression of matrix metalloproteinases is part of the tumor microenvironment. It's what causes cancer cells to be able to be invasive. And so remember that when we want to protect the blood-brain barrier, we also want to look for things that downregulate the matrix metalloproteinases. So we have here, salvia also does that. All right, so the next herb in this particular article, which is talked about four plants, is Panax ginseng, Renshen, and in particular, there's a number of ginsenosides that are really being studied in modern times. This particular paper references ginsenoside RB1 and RG3. They are inhibitory to endothelial cell migration, aggregation, and tube formation, hence also the formation of new capillaries. Interestingly enough, ginsenoside RB1 blocks the estrogen receptor beta, so that makes it a selective estrogen receptor modulator, which is what tamoxifen is. And then the ginsenoside RG3 is an inhibitor of VEGF. It also will enhance the cytotoxic effect of oxaliplatin and 5-FU, which are our two chemotherapy agents widely used in a multiplicity of cancers, inhibits endothelial cell migration, induces apoptosis, reduces expression of BCL2, that's part of the apoptotic signaling pathway, and inhibits both VEGF and VEGF receptors and fibroblast growth factors and matrix metalloproteinases. And I have a nice reference article, an additional article on the impact of ginsenoside, RG3, having impact on cancer stem cells as well. And a couple of other references I've included here for you, one of which speaks to the impact of ginsenosides on the AKT, PI3K-AKT-mTOR pathway as well. So these are pathways that are being widely studied now in oncology and don't have a lot of good treatments, or the treatments that are available are super toxic with a lot of adverse effects. So if we know that these pathways are involved in a particular tumor cell line, for example, the PI3K-AKT-mTOR pathway is present in many, but in, for example, in breast cancer is very common. So then we can think about what we want to include in our treatment plan if we know from a pathology or tumor cell analysis more of the traits of this patient's tumor cells. Lastly, in this paper, curcuma longa, Yujin Jin Huang, this is a turmeric rhizome, and the curcuminoids are inhibitors and downregulators of vascular endothelial growth factor, fibroblast growth factor, protein kinase C that's involved in apoptosis in the mitochondria. We know that the curcuminoids are anti-inflammatory. They inhibit NF-kappa B and TNF-alpha. Also the matrix metalloproteinases. They also inhibit cell adhesion. Vitamin D has that property as well, and reduce the ability of the endothelial cells to attach and also reduce cell motility. So what is it that curcumin doesn't do? That's what we want to know. Just remember with curcumin and salvia, if you give high doses, you can reduce platelet aggregation, and you don't want to cause anticoagulation. So just be mindful of your patient's coagulation status, their platelet counts, and whether or not they're on anticoagulants when you introduce botanicals like that. Earlier I mentioned feverfew, which is tenacetum parthenium, and the one of the active constituents is parthenolide as an inhibitor of hypoxia-inducible factor 1, and it also inhibits the change from the epithelial to the mesenchymal phenotype, which is a transitional phase that is towards metastasis and therefore related to angiogenesis. So parthenolide is anti-angiogenic and anti-metastatic. It's also super anti-inflammatory. I use it in a lot of my formulas. And so I've given you a slide and some references on parthenolide. And then I've also included here hinokiol. I talk about that quite a lot. It's one of my favorite phytochemicals from Chinese magnolia bark with a lot of studies. It is anti-angiogenic. And of course, it also has a multiplicity of gifts, being anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, antimicrobial, induces apoptosis and cell cycle arrest. It's used traditionally as a sedative and anxiolytic. Use it in a lot of patients to help them get sleep. But if you have a particularly anxious patient, which many cancer patients are, then you can think of it in that niche as well in your treatment plan. It does cross the blood-brain barrier. So I've given you also a number of references for hinokiol. And then last but not least is modified citrus pectin, which is one of my absolute favorites. If a patient has metastatic cancer, then you always want to include modified citrus pectin because it is so powerful at inhibiting disease progression and metastasis. So it's anti-angiogenic and anti-metastatic. Remember, it is a complex that's a water-soluble, indigestible polysaccharide, which makes it a probiotic, a prebiotic as well. It also binds to heavy metals, so it's a chelator, and it's very useful in autoimmune disease as well as cancer, as well as in cardiovascular disease, because it binds to galectin 3, and galectin 3 is present in all of these chronic diseases, and particularly in this setting, it really allows angiogenesis and metastasis to progress. But by binding it up, you can inhibit that, and in doing so, you will block tumor cell aggregation and the docking of the cancer cells on the galectin 3, and then you get an inhibition of the interactions with the endothelium that are necessary for angiogenesis. So you're also decreasing cell adhesion and aggregation, downregulates growth factors, not only VEGF, but EGFR, epithelial growth factor, and it inhibits BCL2, so it promotes apoptosis by blocking BCL2. It also decreases immune evasion, which occurs, you know, some tumor cells will inactivate the T cells and thereby disable the normal immunity that would be active in the presence of cancer cells. So I really love using a modified citrus pectin. In people who are have hypertension, it's high in sodium. So if somebody is sodium sensitive, you have to be careful with modified citrus pectin. But the therapeutic dose of modified citrus pectin is around 15 grams a day. And you can divide that into two equal doses. It needs to be diluted in hot water. It won't dissolve otherwise. It's fairly tasteless, but it does need to be taken at least 30 minutes away from food, nutrients, supplements, medications, because it's a binder. It binds to almost everything. And so you don't want it to bind up medications or nutrients. So you just need to take it away from other things. And I've given you a slide also on Dr. Isaac Elias' kind of dosing guidelines. So if you're monitoring serum levels of galectin 3, which a lot of labs don't measure, but LabCorp does, then you look at the serum level, you look at, you know, the medical history and risk factor profile for your patient, and then you can decide your dosing. In our context here, he generally will be giving patients around 15 grams a day. If you have really active aggressive metastatic disease, you might want to go up to 25 grams, but my experience is it's really hard for patients to do that. So shooting for 15 grams a day is reasonable and manageable. And I just have to make sure you remind the patient to take it away from everything else. And then I've also just included a slide at the end here. Dr. William Lee of the Angiogenesis Foundation recently published a book for the patient population called Eat to Beat Disease. And it's a nice little book for patients on the power of food to change our health and change our physiology and change our gene expression. So I put that in here for you. It's a nice waiting room book. And I also put a link to a TED Talk that Dr. Lee did many years ago, which is a really great TED Talk on this topic. And it's geared toward the general public and the patient population about how many foods that we could choose to put in our diet that would have this just huge, huge impact. So that is my mini presentation on angiogenesis. I want to say that I barely touched on all of the phytochemicals that are active, but you could see by the two early slides that there's lots of big families of phytochemicals. And so a colorful diet in and of itself will be anti-angiogenic. So I will stop here. If you would like to comment or ask a question, just press *7. And Kirsten, are you looking at the chat box? I hope to see if anybody typed anything in there. Okay. So you'll have another chance to ask questions if you want to. The next thing I want to do is go over this malignant melanoma case. It was submitted by Isabel Galliano. She lives in Singapore. And we have quite an international group. Oh, there's somebody. Who's that? Bob, you want to ask the question?
No, I'm sorry. I'm okay.
Okay, mute yourself because it's really loud. Can you just mute yourself, please?
Yep.
Thank you. Yeah. All right. Thanks. All right. So we have a really international group here, which excites me a lot. We have people in Africa and the UK and India and Mexico. And it's really wonderful. All right. So this is a 50-year-old female patient who was diagnosed with invasive malignant melanoma on the left lower thigh, which she had surgical excision with clear margins. She's just a stage 1B. And there was a nodal nevus. There were two nodes with micrometastases. The slides were sent by the oncologist in Singapore to Mayo Clinic for opinion. And the report from Mayo is included, will be uploaded if you want to read it. But Mayo Clinic did not recommend any more therapy. One of the questions that Isabel has is, what about immunotherapy, since we now have Keytruda, pembrolizumab, for the treatment of malignant melanoma? And I think that I agree with Mayo from the point of view is that we have stage one. It looks like we have clear margins. We could definitely be worried about these micrometastases, but it's also not an aggressive tumor cell line. And so, we like to keep something in our back pocket if we do need something aggressive at some point. But this doesn't look particularly virulent from our vantage point with the information we have. I do want to note on the lab work I reviewed from this patient that the CRP was 5.3, but I don't know how close it was to the surgery. So I'm sorry, I'm not clear on that. But this woman also showed no evidence of any distant metastases on her scans. Of course, that doesn't mean there isn't something microscopic. But again, when I see a patient like this, when you want to think about immunotherapy, you always want to think about that risk-benefit ratio. And since the patient's fairly low risk for recurrence, but there's so many adverse effects with Keytruda, and we could just give this woman autoimmune disease. And what are we going after? A few tiny microscopic cells. So since we have a large toolbox and a way to really change the tumor microenvironment and the signaling environment and gene expression with our approach, then I think it's reasonable, if the patient is engaged and compliant, to feel like we can do more than wait and watch, which is what the standard of care oncology choice would be at this time. Isabel notes that she has multiple breast cysts, cervical dysplasia, chronic constipation, fatigue. She's a divorced mother, a school teacher, lots of stress, poor sleep, sedentary lifestyle, describes herself as exhausted, low energy, with poor self-esteem and poor self-confidence and a poor support system. So, when I see a patient like this, then I think, well, I'm not going to give her a really complicated treatment plan, but I still want to hit all the bases. So then we want to go back to think about our biggest levers and the botanicals and nutraceuticals that are really truly multitaskers and address a large number of pathways and bind to a large number of receptors and do a lot of jobs with a smaller amount of supplements. If you have someone who's already overwhelmed and needs to kind of change her relationship to herself in order to have better self-care. So my goal for a patient like this would be to help her do things where she actually feels better, so she's motivated to keep going and to continue and then to try new things and slowly over time. And so this is the kind of patient who needs a coach. But that is, Isabel is a functional medicine nutritionist. And so she's well positioned to really help her to implement and make lifestyle changes. And in my practice, I have a wonderful functional medicine nutritionist, Kirsten Neusgruber, who is on the call here with us today. And she helps me to help patients transform in this way. I couldn't do it without her. And so this is someone who part of their healing path, this patient, is to learn what health is and what causes health. And that's part of our framework. So we're not just talking about disease. And so what I often say to patients is, okay, now we're going to change the conversation and we're not going to be disease focused. We're going to be health focused. And that helps the patient step into a new universe and a way of being. So it's not all about cancer anymore, but it's about looking around at the rest of their life and having the energy to fully engage and be well and not have another cancer conversation. And I often say to patients, okay, I'm going to ask you to do a lot of hard things, but that's because I don't want to have this conversation with you ever again. And so you have to speak to what engages patients and their emotions and what they really want for themselves as well. So I made some notes here on considerations, one of which is immunotherapy. So we just want to be aware. It's a choice. It's in the toolbox that should we ever need it, we could consider it. But also for a patient like this, we might consider oral copper chelation with tetrathiol molybdate. When you have no evidence of disease and low tumor burden, that's an opportunity to practice a very aggressive anti-angiogenic therapy. I think that would be hard for this particular patient. It's an expensive therapy, but we might want to monitor her copper and zinc levels and optimize her zinc and take very high copper foods out of her diet because angiogenesis is a copper-dependent process. There is a clinical pearl lecture on copper and copper and angiogenesis in our library. There is a clinical pearl lecture on Hinokiol. There is a clinical pearl lecture on modified citrus pectin. So for those of you who were not aware of those lectures, there's, you know, slide decks and references and recordings if you want to learn more deeply about those things that I mentioned. For this patient, we could also consider pulsed IV vitamin, high-dose IV vitamin C as a cytotoxic therapy, although her tumor burden is rather low and she has or negligible, microscopic, and she does not have an aggressive tumor cell line. But, you know, someone like this who doesn't have zero risk and has a potentially lethal cancer, I might have them do a course, an eight-week course of high-dose IV vitamin C between 1,500 grams, whatever they tolerate, twice a year for 8 weeks just to scavenge any cells because melanomas are deadly. So that might be a way to have more insurance. IV or sub-Q mistletoe therapy I like very much because that's an immunotherapy. So if we want to think about mobilizing her immune system more. But, of course, we have a lot of herbs to do that. So I'm just putting those things for you to think about. I also listed here on my notes for you the pathways to think about that are active in melanoma so that you can think about botanicals that activate those pathways. We've mentioned a couple already in speaking about the herbs that impact angiogenesis, the PI3K AKT pathway, the MAPK pathway. BRAF mutations are common in melanomas, and you would find this out from the pathology report by reading the pathology report. A lot of these tumors have lost the expression of P10, the tumor, a very important tumor suppressor gene. So Hinokiol is really great for activating P10, also curcumin. The Wnt/B catenin signaling pathway, we just mentioned several herbs in our angiogenesis clinical pearl about that. Cell adhesion, ecadherin, optimizing vitamin D addresses that. COX-2 and NF-kappa-B are, of course, inflammatory, and so we want to have good inflammation control. And Isabel asked, what would you monitor in terms of biomarkers in the serum? So we definitely want to monitor zinc, ceruloplasmin, and copper as markers of angiogenesis. We want to look at, and ceruloplasmin and is also a marker of inflammation. And we'd want to be watching CRP, which is already high. So I'd put her on a strong anti-inflammatory botanicals anyway. And then I'd watch her CRP and make sure it comes down because she could have had a low-grade infection. She could have been post-op with that CRP. So we don't really know why it was there, if it was transient or if it's persistent. So you want to watch that. I'd watch her neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio and fibrinogen and D-dimer activity, because if you get a baseline at this stage of her journey, then, and you follow her and do these biomarkers going forward, you'll see if there's trend in any direction or if she's stable. You could definitely watch serum VEGF in melanomas, as well as serum vitamin A and CoQ10. So those are all tests you can order. I do want to say that Isabel presented with her case a very thoughtful and thorough treatment plan of her own that really covered a lot of bases. And I look at this treatment plan that I'm presenting as how to think more specifically about melanoma itself. So you learn a little bit about the botanicals that are more active against malignant melanoma. But I was really impressed with the thoroughness and thoughtfulness of the treatment plan. So I encourage everyone to read it. It is attached to my notes. You can see what Isabel presented. And so we'll just dial it in a little bit more, but it really spoke to the whole person and all of the factors. And you can tell by just the description that she knows her patient well. And there's, you know, no substitute for that when you're thinking about how to go about a treatment plan and help someone. So I want to bring to your attention in discussing this case, targeted support for malignant melanoma. So there's a couple of things, and I've listed a fairly complex treatment plan here, which I realize this patient cannot afford. So I've put in bold the things I think are the most important to definitely include. So curcumin, resveratrol are active against malignant melanoma. There's a lot of studies on grapeseed, EGCG, and milk thistle and malignant melanoma. So I would definitely include those. There's some activity from berberine, but if you had to pick, I'd pick curcumin, grapeseed, EGC, and milk thistle. I would also include medicinal mushrooms. I like the Clinical Synergy Mycoceutics mushroom blend, but any high quality mushrooms to just boost immunity. Also, there is a tendency towards hypercoagulation with melanomas. So I like to put in something like Salvia miltiariza, the Don Shin, which we just talked about as an anti-angiogenic. I also like Pinocchiol because it reduces P10 expression. We just talked about that, and reduces angiogenesis, and the Pexasol to reduce disease progression and angiogenesis. So fairly straightforward, and nice that we just did that angiogenesis lecture, because that's what you want to think about when you have somebody who's had, has been diagnosed at a fairly low grade, and we just don't want them ever to have a recurrence or any progression. So you have to think about all the spokes on the wheel of the tumor microenvironment, one of which is angiogenesis, and this treatment plan, we're quenching oxidative stress, we're attending to glycemic control, we're managing inflammation, we're looking at managing hypercoagulation and immune signaling. So as long as you think about all those factors in the tumor microenvironment, make sure you have something in your treatment plan that will address them. Remember, every spoke on the wheel doesn't need 10 things. It just needs one thing. And so on each spoke on the wheel, you might have the same botanical in several places because of the multitasking quality of molecules from nature. And so you can build a more simple plan for people if you need to. Then we want to think about not only targeted nutraceuticals and phytochemicals and botanicals, but we also want to think about what's the basic foundation nutrient needs of a patient long term. So I like to always include a simple multi. Remember, we want to choose multis that are copper free and iron free, unless the patient is iron depleted, and then we can just replete their iron and measure it separately. But because tumor cells sequester iron and copper is useful for angiogenesis, then we want to pick multis that are free of iron and copper. Then we want to put in the omega-3 fatty acids, some magnesium, vitamin D, and CoQ10. For a patient of her age, I would also put in some bone minerals. So put in OsteoBen, which is a copper-free osteoporosis prevention formula, and has a little genistein in it. I think a patient like this would do well to have some zinc to oppose copper, just as a anti-angiogenic strategy. Vitamin A is useful in all skin cancers, and I'm including enantotocotrienols more and more in my protocols. This is in the vitamin E family. There is a clinical pearl on tocotrienols for those of you that did not hear that talk. And I'm very, very impressed with the very recent research on tocotrienols. And I think that it's a good tool for us to put into our treatment plans. Average dose is 600 milligrams a day. And just remember that tocotrienols interact with tocopherol vitamin E. So the multi I've selected for this patient, ProThriver Wellness Multi by Integrative Therapeutics, is free of tocopherols. It was designed by Lise Alschuler, who is a wonderful integrative oncologist, naturopath. And so she intelligently put tocotrienols instead of tocopherols in there so we wouldn't have to worry about this competition. But there is not a therapeutic dose of tocotrienols in the multi, so I am adding it here. So you think about, you know, skin cancers have more oxidative stress as a trigger. So think about things that protect the skin from oxidative stress, like EGCG and vitamin A, for example. All right, so that's sort of my basic treatment plan for this person, along with the lifestyle and interventions and the sort of psychological and emotional growth and development that this woman, if she embarks upon, will be able to have better self-care and better self-worth and an ability, hopefully, to enjoy her life more. So that's my approach. I just want to point out a couple of resources, good papers, and they'll also be listed on the call summary sheet for you. But there were some really good papers. One, Emerging Phytochemicals for Prevention of Melanoma Invasion. That was published in Cancer Letters in 2013 in the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology, a very nice paper. Low plasma coenzyme Q levels as an independent prognostic factor for melanoma progression. And you can order serum CoQ10s from most labs. Another paper, serum copper and zinc levels in melanoma patients. So again, you can monitor those. It's kind of part of our routine care to do so and optimize the zinc copper ratio to 1:1. Another paper from 2016, bioactive proanthocyanidins inhibit growth and induce apoptosis in human melanoma cells by decreasing the accumulation of beta catenin. That was a cell study. And then a 2019 paper that is entitled Dietary Compounds in Cutaneous Malignant Melanoma, Recent Advances from a Biological Perspective. And this is a really great paper. I think it's worth taking a look at. So I use these papers as a reference to build this treatment plan as well. And so I will stop here and I will allow you to ask questions about this case study. So you can press *7 if you would like to comment or interject or ask questions.
Hello, Stacy.
Oh, Stacy, I have a question for you coming up.
So yeah, go ahead. Well, while we're on mushrooms, yeah, there's a couple papers on shaga is specifically inhibits melanoma cells.
Oh, great! I didn't come across that one. Thank you. If you want to share the reference, we'll put it in the library for everyone.
Sure.
If you have it. Yeah, we'll put it in the library. Thank you.
Sure.
Anything else?
This is Isabel.
Hi, Isabel.
Hi. If you notice in my paper, I also put a secondary diagnosis that she has BRAF V600 mutated.
Yes.
And I was reading a little bit about inhibitor therapies. I don't know what you think about that.
I didn't address it in this study, but you know, I can go back and actually do a little clinical PEARL and BRAF mutations and see what reliable studies we have. As my guess, we mostly have cell and murine studies on botanicals and nutraceuticals. So if I can't find at least one human study, I'm a little reticent to, you know, say we should use it for sure.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a great case. And I really, again, want to say you really did a very, very thorough treatment plan and just, you know, needed a little bit of you know, what actually addresses melanoma and, you know, what to include with more weight in your treatment plan.
Thank you. It was very helpful.
Good. Good. All right. Anybody else? Okay, so I'm going to bring forward this question and my opinion, and then Stacy, if you want to weigh in, I would really appreciate it, because this is about glioblastoma. So Kiran Sangha says, Dr. Lise Alschuler mentioned in one of her courses that you should avoid lion's mane or basically anything that increases brain-derived neurotrophic factor during glioblastoma multiforme treatment, as these can increase the growth of CNS tumors. I noticed in one of your case summaries that you did prescribe lion's mane to a GBM patient. Would you have any thoughts regarding this precaution, or have you not found it to be an issue? Lion's mane is something I would like to prescribe to my clients with glioblastoma, but have been reluctant to do so after hearing this. Do you have any thoughts on the concomitant use of memory-enhancing herbs like bacopa, rosemary, sage during active treatment with timidor and radiation? Dr. Alschuler also expressed concern with any pharmaceuticals such as SSRIs or nutraceuticals like 5-HTP, which increase serotonin, as these may increase glial cell line-derived neurotrophic factor, which, again, could promote growth and invasion of glioma cells. Do you stay away from these during active treatment, more so the nutraceuticals like 5-HTP, or if so, would you look to include these in your protocol if depression is an issue? So that's really like 10 questions, right? So let me just respond, and then I'd love if you would weigh in, Stacy. All right, so I agree that we should be very thoughtful if we know that something is going to promote neuronal growth factors. We should be conservative around that, but I'm going to qualify it, and so listen to my whole answer. But in general, I agree with Dr. Altshuler, and I also have enormous respect for her, and she really does her homework, and she really, anything that she recommends has very solid studies to back it up. She's a very research-based clinician and very experienced clinician. She, however, is the colleague from whom I learned about lion's mane being so valuable in cognitive impairment in cancer patients. So before I give the rest of my answer, I want to just say that oncology care is always shades of gray. There's nothing very black or white about oncology care. So we have to look at the patient in front of us. We have to look at the predicaments and the multiple paradoxical factors and truths that are all simultaneous in these complex patients, and think about what we have to offer and what our goals are here. So when I think about a glioblastoma patient, I feel like this is a person with a shortened lifespan. And I want, pardon me, I want that person's lifespan to be as high quality as possible. So if that person has a history of severe depression, I would not take them off their antidepressant. And unless there was a really good reason to do so, because the anxiety and stress and elevated cortisol, not only is the diagnosis, but the extremely difficult and challenging treatments that these patients go through, and also the loss that they go through, the loss of function, the loss of the self they once knew, and the loss of the life they once had, is pretty devastating. So If someone's been on an antidepressant for a long time, it's high risk for depression. I would be very careful. I certainly wouldn't introduce anything serotonergic into a treatment plan, but I would be very careful in service to their quality of life and their suffering emotionally. I would just be very careful and feel that I'd done a very thorough assessment of really their history, how long they'd been medicated, et cetera, if their depression breaks through, if they have good coping skills and resilience, do they have a good social support system, emotional support system, all those things go into a decision like that. So that's very personal, but it also matters what the patient wants for themselves. My experience is anyone who's suffered depression doesn't want to suffer more depression. So you have to get to know the person and find out if it would be too risky to remove them from something serotonergic. So given the fact that we are also doing powerful therapies on these patients in the standard of care oncology setting, I don't like to rock the boat too much. I don't like to change too many things. I would like us to be interjecting stability and solid ground and a good foundation that helps them to cope with everything that's happening to them. So that's my general answer. To answer more specifically, I do think that you can include things that are good for brain health, that are good for brain inflammation. So you can think about bacopa and ginkgo and centella, although ginkgo is very antioxidant, so I'm going to think about that. I'll speak to that in a moment. But I do think that things like boswellia and the curcuminoids and the omega-3 fatty acids, vitamin D, things we know cross the blood-brain barrier and simply have an impact on the tumor microenvironment in a positive and not disruptive way, I think those are worth thinking about. Always remember that the microbiome and the gut-brain interaction, that we want to make sure the person has a nice, healthy gut microbiome, and taurine can be useful also in this setting. So I don't worry about using things like that. With polyphenols and flavonoids and flavones, Dr. Dwight McKee feels that those types of antioxidant molecules are not disruptive to most therapies. We just did a clinical pearl on should patients undergoing radiotherapy use antioxidants? And my feeling is we don't really know. And so I'd rather err on the side of conservatism, especially when we have a cancer that is so aggressive and we want to be sure we don't interfere with potentially effective therapy like radiotherapy that could buy the patient some time. Things that definitely interact with radiotherapy are things like glutathione, ascorbic acid, and acetylcysteine, and any of the NRF2 promoters. I would be careful of those. So that's sort of my big answer to that collection of questions. And Stacey, do you want to weigh in? Just for those of you who don't know, Dr. Stacey DeAndre is a neuro-oncologist trained also in functional medicine.
Am I muted or am I on?
You're on.
I'm on. Okay. So, yeah, this is a little bit complicated because, you know, anything that you do to increase BDNF in the brain, you know, that's going to have should have improvements in cognition.
Right.
And these people, you know, they go through surgery, they go through chemo, radiation. I mean, they're getting a lot of neuronal damage from all of the treatment. And, you know, they're pretty trashed. Now, of course, there's zero human studies, so you just have to keep that in mind. You know, there's no studies on any mushrooms or anything, you know, effectiveness in terms of, you know, making people feel better or cognitive changes, specifically in glioblastoma patients. Now, in terms of, you know, stimulating tumor growth, there's the brain tumor cells have different receptors on them. They have the BDNF receptors. They also have pro-BDNF receptors. So I think what, you know, what I'd like to look into is, do we know if lion's mane, is it increasing pro-BDNF or just BDNF? Because pro-BDNF is actually anti-cancer. And there are other actually papers in cell, most of this, all of it is in animal models and in cell culture, that the BDNF helps the normal brain cells and helps repair normal brain cells, but it does not affect the tumor cells. There's a differential response. So it is complicated, but I think, you know, the papers that I've read, they suggest more of an anti-tumor effect and pro, good neuronal protective effect. And I've used it in my patients. I can't, you know, with brain tumor patients, it's so hard to know what is making them better. If you're doing multiple things with them, you know, it's very difficult to know what treatment is actually helping them. So I have used it. I mean, I haven't seen anything, you know, strange happen. But then again, there's no human data yet in terms of what this is doing.
Right, right. I definitely use lion's mane in patients who have experienced a cognitive impairment as a result of chemotherapy or as a result of just having cancer or brain radiation, maybe because they had a metastatic lesion in their brain. But I think that the way that I look at glioblastoma patients is I still want them to feel like they have some quality of life left. And so I also feel it's really a shade of gray. But again, we have a lot of other adaptogenic herbs that we might not worry about so much in terms of neurotrophic factors. So since we don't know, I have a question for you then, Stacey. Would you, if the patient has very aggressive glioblastoma and is fairly treatment resistant, would you just focus on their quality of life then?
If they're treatment resistant, yeah, I definitely, you know, especially if they're not methylated. Remember when you get a report back on a patient, you want to know, are they methylated or are they not? If they're not methylated, they are not going to do well for the most part. That's a very, very aggressive phenotype, and they progress usually, you know, within a lot of times, even while they're on therapy, and they are resistant to Temodar. So, yeah, I mean, definitely want to focus on quality of life, especially in that population. But there are, you know, there are a lot of things that we can use. I mean, I use a lot of cannabis in my GBM patients because of a human study actually out of Europe that showed a benefit. Small study, but it did show a benefit. And Boswellia decreases the edema. So I've used a lot of boswellic acid in decreasing edema. So there's a lot of things you can focus on without putting them through a lot.
Would you explain for people who don't know what it means when you say, are they methylated?
Sure. So methylation is just an actual, it's not what we think of in, you know, functional. It's not, you know, MTHFR. It's not all of that. It is actually a feature of the tumor cell itself. So it's looking at the genome and if it is what we call hypermethylated or not methylated. So it's run by, it's a PCR test that they run. And they'll give you, it's not either plus or minus. If it's positive, there's shades of positive. So you can be very highly methylated. And those people tend to do very, very well. They have a good prognosis and a good response to chemotherapy. And then lower, you know, lower grades of methylation. And then you have people who are below the cutoff who are negative, and those are the people that do very poorly.
And is that because methyl groups impact gene expression, or is it for a different reason?
Yeah, I don't think it has to do, I think it's a different reason. It's a different mechanism. It's not the typical.
It's metabolic. It's something metabolic.
Yes. It's metabolic. It's different than when we think of methylation in terms of, you know, we think of methylation, you know, as a good thing in terms of detoxing and all of that. This is a separate tumor specific feature.
Right. Thank you. And what dose of Boswellia do you use in these patients?
So I've used, I'm trying to remember the last one I used. I'm studying right now for my test, so I have like doses that I can't even. There's a paper out. I'm sure you have the reference in there too. I use whatever the paper. There was a paper published that showed in patients undergoing Timodar and radiation, they had a decrease in edema on MRI scans using boswellic acid. So I'll find that paper, and I've just used whatever dose they had in that paper.
Yeah, I think I have that paper in my cognitive lecture.
Yeah.
But I tend to go higher than a lot of studies just because of my experience with botanicals and because I understand their margin of safety just to get more impact. So I'll use somewhere around 3 to 5 grams a day. They have a lot of brain edema.
I think it was 4,000 a day, but
Great. Okay, so it's a little after 6:30 my time here. Are there any other attendees who would like to ask a question or of any topic and or make a comment? Okie dokie. Well, thank you everyone for your attention. And remember that if you want to submit a case or a question, I need it 2 weeks from now. And that gives me time to work on it and do a thorough study and update all the references. So I look forward to hearing what you want to talk about next. If you also just want to let us know if you have a request for a clinical pearl, I know there's been a request for circulating tumor cells. And I am going to do something on liquid biopsies at some point, but there's so much information, and I want to make sure if we just do a short lecture, I have something really clear for you. So I've not forgotten that request. So thank you, everyone, and we'll circle back in a month. Good night.